problem. Game in love, they see me as a problem. Imagine I have a minuki, the problem. I give them a cure with a fresh new album. I'm a rider, provider. Bring the heat, girl, I will bring the fire. And my name keeps going worldwide. So my job is to satisfy ya.
What's up, what's up, what's up, what's up, everybody? Welcome back. This is Recon Towers, Food for Thought. Thoughts if it were you. This is your host, Neo Gentrix. We have been talking about a lot of different things. We started with the learning series. I told you that we would cover all the different types of learning so that you'd be able to understand them better. And, you know, understand how to learn more efficiently. These are things that schools don't teach people. I wish they did, because if they did, people would be able to learn more efficiently. They'd be able to learn and know their style of learning so that they can improve on the way they do things. If you can't learn something one way, learn it through a different method. You know, that's just how we do. I hope everybody's been having a great week. So far, every now and then, I'm only going to be doing maybe 2 or 3 episodes each week until I get back up to the speed where I'd like to be. Thank you guys for sticking with me through all of this. So look forward to another 2 or 3 episodes this week. So we'll go ahead and get started. Today, we're going to talk about the learning approaches. Those are things that people need to know how to go about when determining what their learning style is, okay? Next time, we'll be covering learning styles. There are 8 different types, but we'll cover those in a minute. But first off, like I said, there are so many different ways to approach this, and how you learn is one of those things that you need to learn how to be able to handle or deal with. So over the years, many theories have been developed to examine the process involved with learning, and most learning theories concentrate on the significance for the way that learning is delivered to you. So there are many different ways of learning, both formally and informally, as part of a group, such as a classroom setting, one-on-one, you know, mentoring, coaching, or just self-learning if you're one of those types. Furthermore, people learn differently at different times in their lives and in different circumstances, okay? These approaches that I'm going to cover, there's 3 of them. They are, first off, the one that is concerned with the learner's response to some form of stimulation is called the behavioral approach. We're going to cover that. And then there's one that deals with knowledge and knowledge retention, like, you know, getting ready to take a test and making sure you remember the information that you learned. That's cognitive. That's this cognitive approach. And then there's the humanist approach, which is based on explanations of, you know, another person's experience, whether yours or someone else's. So these are the 3 different approaches that we have that are capable of being used to teach somebody how to learn something. And I'm going to go ahead and try to go into them as best as I can, so that you understand the theory behind this. I'm going to keep it as simple as possible. I don't want to go off into some tangent. I'm not trying to make it seem like, you know, I'm saying you're unable to learn if you're not able to use one of these 3 methods. No. Everyone should be able to use all 3 methods, but some people are either medically incapable or so on and so forth. So take it with a grain of salt. Find out which method works best for you. Use that. It doesn't mean you can't use the other methods. It just means that you would have to learn or try a little harder to do so. So there's something to look forward to. And let's get started. All right, everybody, welcome back. Let's go ahead and start talking about the behaviorist approach, okay? This approach, the one I mentioned before, is based on the idea that the learner responds to a stimulating environment, okay? The role of the learning facilitator here for this thing is is supposed to provide relevant and useful stimuli, something that stimulates the learner so that they respond to and gains the required knowledge and experience of whatever it is that they're trying to teach them, okay? In this approach to learning, it centers around the belief that the appropriate behavior can be taught through constant repetition of certain tasks and combined with feedback from the facilitators, the people that are in charge, okay? So positive feedback encourages and reinforces success, while negative feedback and intermediate correction discourages the repetition of any mistakes or desirable behaviors. This is something that is noted, especially when teaching animals. Believe it when I say that it does work when teaching animals. So this is something that can be used for humans or for animal training, for lack thereof. Proof of this would be back in 1927 with Ivan Pavlov. I can't pronounce this guy's name. He conducted a famous experiment with dogs. He taught the animals to salivate on hearing a certain bell ringing, signifying that it was time to feed them. Okay. Later, he stopped feeding them in this method, but the dogs continued to salivate when they heard the bell regardless. In other words, it became a learned behavior as a result of all the sequence of events that he had done to go through to train them, and became more than just a conscious thought process by the dogs. Okay, what he discovered was known at, or rather, termed as classical conditioning. Okay. This kind of conditioning can be used to develop repetitive actions within training, or muscle memory, if you will. For example, looking in the mirror and putting your seatbelt on before driving off in a car. Those are just examples of spontaneous behaviors that have been learned and become repetitive actions. Okay? The association between the stimulus response can be made more effective by reinforcement. Again, like I mentioned earlier, this is the idea that underpins the theory that, you know, back then, it was, how do I phrase this? It was developed by B.F. Skinner in 1957, saying that reinforcement can work in both positive and negative ways. A positive reinforcer is anything that strengthens the desired response that you want the person to have in training, and aims, and where the aim is learning, for example. This can be, might be stimulated by verbal phrasing, good marks, a feeling of achievement. On the other hand, if verbal praise is withdrawn, this will also have a negative effect, and the motivation to learn will, you know, monumentally decrease. So, not all the time, like a lot of the times, compliments can be considered derogatory. They can be seen as being overly ambitious, or just trying to get someone to do something that you want them to do. But at the same time, while you're doing that, keep in mind that this is also a way of behaviorally training somebody unintentionally. They think that because you're complimenting them, that you're doing what you want them to do. And a lot of people misconstrue this as thinking that they're needed, that they're wanted by this person, that they want them to do this, they want them to act this way, they want them to be this way, when in reality, they're defining who they are, and that's probably not what that person wants, unless that person is a tool and they're just using you. Please keep this in mind. Okay, one of the main ways to use behavioral approach is to learning and training and teaching is to specify clear behavioral objectives at the start, and then supply learning opportunities that ensure that the objectives are met. So the approach is based on the view that there is one right way, one truth that the student or the person needs to learn, and that that knowledge is the same for all the learners in the room. For this reason, it emphasizes teacher and trainer control. Okay, the trainer employs external reinforcement to motivate and encourage the trainees to reach that stated objective. Okay, there was a theory that was created years ago called the theory of instruction, created by R.M. Gain, spelled G-A-G and accented E. I have to think for a minute. I had it written here on a piece of paper, but the most recent proponent of the behaviorist approach can be found in his work. And in his theory, he suggested that learning takes place in a hierarchy way. He proposed that there are 8 stage models, and each stage of which is associated with a type of learning that influences the way that instruction is delivered. And, you know, with that being said, it's basically understood that what he's saying is that learning at one level is only possible if learning at the previous level has already taken place. Okay? So, like I said, you figure out where you are, you can understand what you don't know, and it'll help you grow and learn more efficiently in the future. So to understand this more effectively, based off of what I'm trying to say, is that the 8 different types of learning, based off of his theory, are signal learning and recognition, recognizing that something is happening based off of what you're doing. Stimulus response learning, which is learning the response due to the stimulus, the stimulating environment or stimulus that you're using. Motor chain learning. You're learning the sequence of actions necessary. Then there is verbal chain learning, which is associating words in sequences. Multiple discrimination, which is choosing relevant responses to particular stimuli, which means that certain responses only work to a certain target. The next is concept learning, which is making a common response to a class of stimuli. The last two are acquisition of rules, concepts joining together the guide of the behavior with a set of instructions, and then problem solving, where you combine all the rules and forms of learning that you have together to solve whatever the problem is. If a person has a high skill of problem solving, then that means that they're able to do all the previous ones subconsciously without thinking. And even if you don't think you have any of the other 8 based off of this instruction method, if you're able to problem solve subconsciously, you're able to do the others without thinking. Just so that you understand. Okay? All right, everybody, now that we got through most of that information, let's go ahead and move on. The next thing would be social learning theory. Okay, so we're still talking about the behavioral approach. Okay, we'll get to cognitive in a second, but I want to go ahead and talk about social learning. There's a theory behind this that I want people to understand, that this has to do with the behavior of people and the way they learn. Okay, I'm pretty sure you've all heard of peer pressure, right? It's a thing, okay, where you're pressuring someone to do something that everyone else is doing, or, you know, you feel pressure that you should be doing what everyone else is doing. Okay, this is a behavioral thing. Okay, it's not something that's innately learned from youth. It's something that's learned through social interaction. Okay, the social learning theory is the development of early behavioralism theory, and it proposes that people can learn both directly and indirectly by observing others. And in order for that to become an effective way of learning, learning has to become absorbed into the repertoire of behaviors in a way where it needs to be positively reinforced. However, this isn't always the case, and as you could probably guess, what I'm about to tell you is the positive effects and how this becomes a thing, and then you can understand how peer pressure is the negative side of this and why it should be avoided at all costs. But, you know, society continues on in its own way and people do what they want. So anyway, for this to become an issue, for people to gain this ability and feel that they need to do something because of other people's behaviors and actions, it starts off in 3 stages. First off, attention is focused using a model, usually a child or a parent. Okay? Then learning takes place through observation of the model's behavior and the consequences of the said child. In this case, watching, in this instance, we would use a child watching their parent use the telephone. Okay? We learn these behavioral responses from watching the model in our life, which when growing up becomes our parents. We want to do what they're doing. We see what they're doing. We think what they're doing is okay and right, so we want to do what they're doing. Okay? You see how this is starting to build into what later becomes a negative response due to peer pressure, right? The next thing is the subject analyzes and codes the learning into their own behavior, and then, if anything, starts to imitate the model's behavior if possible. This will then help in the reinforcement process of being able to do what they see the other person do. In other words, if the child can copy the parent's action, the learning it will be reinforced and the action is learned. Okay? Ergo, peer pressure is the opposite of it, where you don't want to do something, but because everyone else is doing it, you feel that you should do it, and then you copy them. Thus, the action is learned. Okay? The social learning approach places great significance on learning with other people through interpersonal reactions, either face-to-face or in a team. And one of the problems of this approach is that people don't copy everything they see, but as individuals, they tend to be selective about what they choose to copy. It is therefore important for other people to demonstrate best practices while using this approach to training and picking up on mistakes quickly before they start copying the mistakes too, as learned behaviors that are positive. Okay? Something I wanted people want you all to understand, that just because everyone else is doing it doesn't mean you need to do it too. Alright, so next we're going to go ahead and get started with the cognitive approach. Now that we finished behavioral approaches, I want you to see what a cognitive approach is, okay? Behavioralist theories of learning essentially stress the importance of the assertiveness of what the tutor is trying to teach you. So, and the passive participant who is not given a great deal of choice other than to respond to a predetermined way. So it's not a very, it's an effective way to train someone, it's just not a very good way to train somebody. If you want to look at it from a moral perspective. In contrast to that, though, the cognitive theories are concerned with the role of the active mind in processing learning opportunities and development. Let's say, let me use an example. The tutor, if present in this scenario, and the participant both engage with knowledge, the role of the tutor is to choosing the best method to convey the understanding. And the work of the of two well-known classical cognitive theories that express this whole thought process to understand it would be John Dewey. Everybody knows John Dewey back in 1938. If you've taken history, you know who this is. If you don't worry about it. And the other one is B.S. Blue. So what did Dewey have to say about this? John Dewey believes that learning involves learning to think. I'm saying that literally. I'm meaning that liberally. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and quote him here. It's going to give me a minute. He says that the process of learning is more than doing a task or an activity. It requires reflection and learning from this. Okay, so to Dewey, the purpose of thought is basically attaining a state of equilibrium, enabling an individual to solve the problem and prepare themselves for further inquiries rather than just giving them the solution or acting a certain kind of way to get a certain result. It's often associated with progressive education. I'm pretty sure y'all have heard of that. Dewey rejected traditional forms of education based on the reinforcement of information where the student had a passive role, suggesting that this type of learning was superficial. He said that learning only occurs if the student plays an active role in the process, actually doing it. Okay? You see how we're getting into the types of learning as we're doing this, right? We'll cover that more in detail next time, but don't worry about that right now. For learning in this regard, okay, to take place, it must be meaningful to the individual. They have to want to do it. The student critically reflects on the information presented. They have to be able to experience the information and the way to facilitate this is to draw on past experiences and show them or make them, allow them to do it. It can be argued, therefore, that Dewey was one of the foremost proponent people of experimental learning, but that's neither here nor there. That's not the point of this, okay? Teachers and trainers employing Dewey's approach to learning play a key role in the learner's development, but it is in a more indirect way than implied by the behavioral format that we mentioned earlier. For example, planning sessions that encourage interaction with material, the material that's presented, and reflective thinking, as well as creating a climate where students or the trainees can structure their own learning based off the information given. Okay, you know, kind of like math class, where they not only explain how the problem works, but they make you come up there and do it too. I'm pretty sure we've all had that opportunity to walk up to the blackboard or whiteboard, whichever it is, and solve it with a piece of chalk or a dry erase marker, depending on where you went to school. or unless everything's digital, then now you do it on a, you know, piece of paper or a tablet, what have you. Okay, so the other one, V.S. Bloom, basically another theorist in the cognitive approach, consider learning occurs in both the cognitive domain that is associated with memory and understanding, and the affective domain, how feelings or emotions change as a result of learning. So basically, this person is saying that the way you remember and do stuff off of memory and understanding is also based off of how you feel at that moment. He suggests that parallel learning between the cognitive and the affective domains of your brain, in a cumulative way, it depends on the degree of difficulty, how hard it is. The degree in which learners can use this will depend on that person. I would use my girlfriend as an example in this, but it's not fair to her if I do that. So let's just use a different person in this approach. So when it comes down to it, cognitive approaches and the affective response in your feelings or your emotional state helps with learning in a certain way. Knowledge, when it comes to the knowledge cognitive aspect, you have to be willing to receive the information. When it comes to comprehensive, you have to be able to respond to the information. When it comes to the application of it, you have to value what you're using and want to use it. When it comes to the analysis and synthesizing of the information to act in the process of applying it, you have to be able to conceptualize. You have to be able to think through it and know that you can do it. Then last but not least, evaluation, being able to organize everything and put it together. You know, get yourself together and focus. So that's the essentials of how Bloom states that this should work. All right. Now that we've gone through all of that, let's go ahead and look at the humanistic approach to learn. Okay, it's the last approach out of the three. It's a more recent theory. It takes into account the way that in our society previously polarizes the views of right and wrong has dissolved into like a variety of potentially equal valuable truths, a pluralistic approach, if you will. The stress on valuing diversity in many organizations and in society generally is a reflection of this ideology. And an emphasis on learning or active learning is at the core of this humanistic approach to learning. The terms, andragogy, because that's about the best way I can pronounce it, and pedagogy, or gogy, whatever. You discern how this should be pronounced. I'm just trying to portray the information. I never was able to pronounce these before, and I still ain't been able to pronounce them now. But the difference between the earlier models that I mentioned before and of training and the more usual approach nowadays would be these two things. They are terms derived from the Greek words meaning child and man, respectively. Okay? Pedagogy is essentially based on instruction, knowledge that is transmitted formally from one who knows to one who doesn't know. This type of model has often been used in institutional settings where it can be administratively easier to assume control of the learning experience while ignoring the abilities or needs of the person to engage in self-directed learning. For example, in schools and other educational establishments, this can be seen and used. Unfortunately, this model can engender resistance or rebellion, particularly in older children, adolescents, or adults. So if you've seen that before, that's probably the reason. It can be claimed that it actually misses the point. Providing training or education does not necessarily mean that the learner will enjoy or remember the experience, even less transfer it to useful settings. Basically, they feel like they are being forced to learn it and they don't want to do that. Andragogy, on the other hand, however, provides us with a process model in which the learner discovers knowledge at a pace that is suitable to themselves and is supported by a facilitator or a coach or mentor that, you know, tries to help them in that regard. The This theory is based on four assumptions that define its unique position against the other, or traditional learning methods. One, the learner needs freedom to develop his or her own learning style, or skill, for that matter. The second one is the existing experience of the learner are fundamental for understanding and new learning to take place effectively. Okay. Third, the person needs to be ready to learn as opposed to being motivated by fear or coercion, being forced to do it. The fourth thing is the orientation to learning is a paramount. In other words, it's not subject oriented, but learner centered, so that they can, focus on what it is that they need. That's just why I structured my podcast the way I have, because I want it to be structured around what the learners need, the people who listen, who want to know this information, rather than certain subjects. It may seem like I'm all over the place, but if this is what you want to learn and this is the recommended or the suggested item that you want to hear me talk about, I will cover that. So, and then I'll go back to the topic that I had started on before. This is why certain topics take a little bit longer to come out. It's not that I don't want to do it. It's because this is what you want to learn about now at the moment, so I'll cover it now. If I'm unable to, I'll finish what I started first and then come back to it. Okay. Informal individual support is important in this method or theory, as it's the development of a group environment that is both positive and accepting. Sharing experiences can deepen individual learning, not only for the cognitive or intelligent processes, but also for the emotional processes that a person has. Participation methods build on both individual and group experiences, aiding in reflection of the information, lengthening the span of the attention, and increasing self-awareness. Learning in this way is often referred to as experimental learning. You'll probably hear that quite often. It was developed by a man named David Kolb. Okay? In his experimental approach, the experiential model of learning that he came up with underpins much of the work of the adult and the modern adult training that they provide. Essentially, he believes that learning is a dynamic process in which we can constantly be able to construct our own learning and develop it by moving through the following cycle I'm going to give you. Okay? Starting, it's a circle, so it's split into four. You can find this up online if you look for Kolb's experimental learning cycle. Okay? There are four things. Concrete experience, which is engaging in a activity or experience. Reflective observation, reflecting on the activity or experience. Active experimentation, trying it out and testing the new skills and abilities. And abstract conceptualization, which is gaining knowledge or skills from the experience of doing it. Okay? He has four aspects of his learning cycle in which experience is constantly repeated and impressed or challenged or confirmed on the basis of an experimental or experiential learning theory, and such helps the person grow. The sequence is explained in the following way. A person's life experiences from the basis of for his or her observation and reflection, what was, has been encountered, encourages learning. This in turn becomes a stimulus into what is already known, provides a new conceptual map on which further actions will be based on this fact, and thus forming a new experience. To complete the cycle, people also need to be able to practice the skills learned if the training is to have any true meaning or effect for them. In training terms, therefore, learning is facilitated if the course content and the process key into participants' existing experience are so designed to encourage reflection and formation of the new concept. Essentially, as long as the training not only enforces the learning but gives them a way to practice it and a way to use it, it's going to help reinforce the way they learn it so that they can do it. All right, guys. Let's go and finish this off with another theory based off of the humanistic approach, and that would be the Bandura self-efficacy theory. Okay, Albert Bandura was a key proponent of social learning, who also popularized the notion of self-efficiency or self-efficacy. His theory takes into consideration how people perceive themselves or how they appraise their own level of competence in the process of learning. People low in self-efficacy will dwell on their perceived inadequacies and difficulty of their situation. Conversely, people high in self-efficacy, I'm just going to stop saying this word. People high in this form will see a situation as a challenge rather than a problem and focus on what needs to be done. They manage threats well and can, you know, apply their knowledge to different situations. It can be defined as people's judgment of their capabilities to organize and execute courses of actions required to attain designated types of performance. Okay, he suggested that the strengths of an individual's convictions in his or her own effectiveness determines whether he or she will even try to cope in different or difficult situations. He points out that the level of self-efficacy may influence a person's performance in many different ways. I have two examples here. The first one is the amount of effort and persistence a person puts into a task. For example, if a person starts an activity with weak expectations or low self-esteem, I'll just use that, it's pretty much the same thing, but this is followed by positive experiences, they are more likely to perceive and persevere through it. However, individuals who have strong expectations will continue to persevere despite negative or dissuading experiences at all. Okay, so even if they don't have the positive experiences, they will still try to persevere just because they have strong expectations of how it's supposed to be. You know, you could be one or the other. You may be one of the ones who need the extra boost to help get you through it. The other option is the actions or tasks people choose. Individuals will be more inclined to undertake tasks in which they have strong expectations and are less inclined to do those linked to weak expectations. So if the outcome seems like it's not worth, you know, the living hell that it's placed on, they're probably not going to bother. This self-efficiency or self-efficacy is derived from a number of sources, which include performance accomplishments, which is basically, these are the most dependable sources of self-efficiency or efficacy expectations, because they are based on one's own personal experiences. And success raises mastery expectations, and repeated failures lower them. Okay. The second one is vicarious experiences, which is watching others undertake fearful or feared activities without negative consequence. This can also create a positive expectation in the observer, and is sometimes referred to as modeling, to, you know, get them to do something that they would otherwise probably never do because they were afraid of the outcome. The third one is verbal persuasion. Okay. Individuals can be led to believe that they can cope successfully. Expectations created in this way, however, tend to be weak. Therefore, you really shouldn't use this unless you have to. And they tend to be weak, and unless accompanied by a authentic experimental or experiential base. Basically, it's very, very weak. It doesn't always work unless you have someone or something there that, you know, helps bring it along or helps with the encouragement. The third one is emotional arousal. This is the one that seems to be more common but misused. People partly rely on their physiological arousal to judge anxiety states. High aversion arousal tends to debilitate performance, whereas with a calm and low arousal setup, success is more likely. If a person is anxious and overly animated in doing something, they're more likely to not do it or fail than if they just calmly, rationally try to think it out. Okay? The implication for training designs are various and includes different settings that are either realistic, but even if they are realistic, they're not too easy a goal that, you know, anybody can achieve them. There's still something they have to work towards. And in order for the people to feel that they've really achieved something and ensure that, you know, people have the support and rewards that is necessary, they have to feel as if they had to work for it to earn it. If it's too easy, they're not going to feel like they gained anything from it, and they're going to come to hate it, okay? Ensuring that people have support and rewards for their learning in either workplace or training environment, regardless of the fact, will help ensure that they learn more efficiently. If all they receive is a negative backlash or a negative outcome, it's going to hinder their learning and then for either make them stop doing what they're doing or stop wanting to be around you, for that matter, if that's the case. This goes not just for a learning environment, but this also goes for a workforce environment as well. Take into consideration that if people feel like they're being stimulated to do something, if they feel like they're wanted and that the environment is a positive one, and that even if it's something that would otherwise be considered impossible to them. If everyone can do it and anybody can do it, they should be able to do it, and they should be able to earn the tasks as well. Okay? Think of it like a self-motivational tactic in a reverse way. All right? It's been fun, guys. Thank you guys for listening to this podcast, learning about the different learning approaches and how they affect people and how you can use them or misuse them. I don't recommend the second one, but still, you know, thank you for listening. This has been Food for Thought, Thoughts If It Were You, sponsored by Recurrent Towers. I hope you all enjoy the rest of your day. Stick around next time. We will talk about the different learning types, like promised. And then we'll get on to the 8 types of learning styles that are more predominant. Okay?